and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is March 8th, 2025. Happy International Women's Day out there. Let's see, this is episode 506. You're listening to Radio War Nerd. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio War Nerd. I'm the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York, and I'm on the line with the War Nerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Briccerio in Italy. John, how you doing?
I'm fine. I'm just hoping that the motorcycles make it by the time we have to record, because if people notice some noise on my end, it's because the little motorcycles are zooming around. They love this part of the world. I guess no traffic enforcement. There are traffic bumps, but they know where they are. Anyway, if there's any noise, that's what it is.
Is this? I'd never heard motorcycles. I mean, I heard them before we were recording. I'd never heard them there. Is this like a migration thing? Like it's springtime and the motorcyclists are migrating south, sort of thing?
It's definitely springtime, but I think they're local. But
oh, okay.
Italians take winter very seriously, and I have to admit, it's a lot colder here on the coast in the winter than we thought it would be. So they're right to take it seriously in a way, but once spring comes, they change their behavior. Like it's not time enough to go in the water. Only the German campers who are in the the trailer park go in the water because they're Germans and they have this vestigial memory that, you know, we used to be tough and we do things. And so there's like 80-year-old Germans going into this pretty darn cold water. But the Italians don't do that. What they do is they get on their color-coordinated leather jackets and pants outfits, and they take these things, which I believe are called pocket rockets in the argo of our time. What does Maude Lebowski say in the parlance of our times? Yeah. And they zoom up and down these streets, and they pass you very dangerously because, I don't know, because they're young men and they don't have a war.
Yeah. There was a kind of funny old South Park episode about middle-aged dudes and their motorcycles and getting really loud wherever they can go, and then they kind of say to each other, people think we're pretty cool, huh?
I remember that they go into the library and they start making that noise.
Yeah. Trying to get attention when people start just rolling their eyes everywhere. Yeah. Yeah, speaking of Germany, this will go slightly out of order, but, you know, today, because there's so much going on, we just wanted, it's the weekend, but we wanted to record sort of a quick update on at least a few things, even though there's a lot going on. But, you know, you mentioned Germany and their old former martial tradition. It's apparently a coming back. So they just had an election and the conservatives won. The bigger shock was that the, you know, Nazi-adjacent, post-Nazi AfD party came in a fairly close second. I mean, all these far-right parties massively increased their numbers after the Ukraine war started in February 2022, and the same thing happened in Germany. And the left, the Linke party, the sort of former communist party, also gained a lot. They're, I don't know, got about 9%. Again, surprised people. So what happened is the German elites decided we need to rearm because the Americans are no longer trustworthy. And A and B, like, you know, we are a lot more nervous than anybody else about Germany, I mean, about Russia moving from eventually Velika Novosilka to Berlin. But also see, they have a lot of, they're in a deep stagnation, partly from the Ukraine war and their stupidity in the Ukraine war. But it's actually an acceleration of a process that's been going on. And, you know, rearming is a way of stimulating. I mean, they had a guy with a mustache who rearmed to stimulate the economy. They have some experience with that. So
yeah, well, I mean, FDR did a lot of stuff, but it was only when he went full on for quite necessary rearmament that the U.S. economy was really transformed.
Yeah. So what they did was they changed the Constitution to allow budget deficits, because the way they keep, you know, social spending in line there all these years, and, you know, and then their excuse also for keeping military spending low, is that the budget deficit has to be under, I think it's 3%, 2% or 3%. And they always use the Weimar era experience with hyperinflation as the reason. And so now they got the Social Democrats and the Greens outgoing and no longer popular. They did this in the outgoing parliament, which is not popular, because they knew they wouldn't be able to do this with the incoming parliament, to change the Constitution to allow for large budget deficits only for defense spending, not for any social programs.
So it's very
Reagan-esque, isn't it? And this is the Greens and Social Democrats.
Yeah, that's the thing about these extreme right-wing parties in Europe. I would like to see a comparison of, like, how scary they are versus the U.S. Republican Party.
Yeah.
I mean, like, how extreme are they? Because that takes some beating.
Yeah.
I mean, they seem more scary because it's Germany and it's got this long shadow behind it. But I don't know. I think you could find Republicans in any state in the country that would top the right-wing parties that I've heard about in Europe. I mean, the Greens, for example. The Green minister, I forget her name, who presided...
Anna Baerbock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one who presided over the militarization of the Ukraine and the involvement in that, and the seppuku of the German economy, just said, yeah we're going to do this. We're going to do this, and I don't care what the voters think.
Yeah, and they didn't. And no, I think I could be wrong, and we could ask our German friends, but my sense about AfD is that they're essentially very neoliberal in a lot of areas. I mean, they're very market-oriented. Where there are scary is if you're an immigrant.
Yeah, well, that's true of the U.S. Republicans, too.
Yes,
yeah. If you're a poor immigrant, anyway.
Yes, yeah. So the big story, though, the there's a lot going on, but the one that's front center for us, I think, the one that's frightening and nauseating and so predictable and infuriating is what's going on in Syria.
Yeah. So, yeah, we thought we would do a quick outline to the extent we can so far of what's going on in Syria. And more immediately, that's the forces that used to be in Idlib, which were mainly HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, under Jolani, which is not his real name either, have been carefully cultivated by the United States, Turkey, NATO, but really U.S. and Turkey and Israel, who are like the local representatives of NATO. And they broke out at the end of the month, and they have now moved toward the heartlands of the minority populations, particularly the Alawite and Druze populations in the south central area. And there are reports of accelerated killing. I mean, that's all you can call it, because there has been killing since they moved out of their Idlib base. It just has gotten very, very little publicity in the Western media. And this is one of the more sickening aspects of what's going on, like the purposeful damping of atrocities that would get constant 24/7 coverage if they happen anywhere else or by anyone else.
Oh, 15-minute segments on the BBC, including, you know, getting family members to cry and that kind of stuff. Like, it would be endless, but it's amazing. It's just, it is, as somebody in the Radio Warner Facebook page said, it's a lot like the Libya playbook. You just blank it out once the country's broken and,
Yeah, and I thought I would try to start this segment by reminding people of what actually happens in these cases. So in this case, we go back to 2019 when Turkish proxies, and really that's all they were because they had no combat power. Their power was the Turkish army and air force backing them. They captured the formerly Kurdish YPG area of Afrin in northwest Syria. And that was that. We haven't heard much from Afrin after that. It's not that nothing happened there. It's that we haven't heard about it. But early on, when they had not yet learned to be quiet with their killings and their rapes, because both were featured. Both are classic means of vengeance in militias that have been previously defeated when they are reinforced and they can swarm over the people they hate. So in 2019, they broke through into Afrin. And it don't bear thinking about. But the one case we know best is that a Kurdish political leader who was named Hevrin Khalaf, and her driver, and she had worked tirelessly for peace among the various communities in Afrin, including Turkmen communities, along with Kurdish and Arab communities. The Turkish militias, who were bent on vengeance, they weren't even Turkish, really. A lot of them were Syrian militias that were like fanatically Sunni, which is another issue. Kurds, in the Salafi view, don't really count as Muslim. It's weird because they insist on being Kurds, and that's not okay.
Right, for the sort of Sunni sectarians, and Sunni Arab sectarians, the Sunni Kurds are not them. So that,
Well, I mean, the forbidden fact is there's a lot of ethnic chauvinism in extreme Islamists. That is, Arab and Muslim tend to merge, and Kurds don't do that. They accept Islam as a rule. Some of them are even strongly Islamic, but for the most part, at the moment, they would sort of prefer to have their Kurdish identity highlighted because that's the one that keeps getting them massacred and sidelined in so many societies. So anyway, they run into some of the mangy Kurds that are following in the Turkish army's footsteps, and they get pulled over on a road. And then from there, we go to handheld videos, which show the assassins shooting both of them. Other reports say Hevrin Khalaf was gang raped before this, but that's not on the videos. But they gather around her with the AKs. They shout insults at her and her driver as they kneel on the pavement, and then they just shoot and shoot and shoot. They perforate them with bullets. So you have to imagine this scene being repeated in many, many places and not getting any publicity from the papers of record because it's really inconvenient.
I would say even worse. I remember Carlotta Gall, who I knew from the Moscow Times years, who was a big basically the PR arm of the Chechen separatists who turned very jihadist too. She did a big piece or two of them for the New York Times, basically saying that, you know, yeah, things are a little rough in Afrin right now, but and Erdogan is really the victim of this. He's just trying to get things to run normally. She's very pro Erdogan. Same with
Gaul is a strange case. I mean, yeah. I recall she did some decent reporting, but then
she
turned bad, and she said things which no one with a conscience could possibly have said.
I mean, there was a mass ethnic cleansing there. It has to be emphasized, and nobody cared at all. And in fact, I even remember the White Helmets moved in with those Free Syrian Army, the SNA, the Syrian National Army, these mangy curs, as you said, these jihadist groups under the Turkish tutelage, and the White Helmets moved in with them and were openly basically mocking the Kurds. And Kurdish media, they're uncomfortable. They don't want to be seen as being anti-White Helmets, knowing that a lot of the people that can, you know, have given them some support deeply believe in the White Helmets, but they were trying to call attention, like, you realize you're covering for and cheering on actual ethnic cleansing, and they were just like, yeah, fuck you. It was awful.
Yeah. Yep, that's it. And there's some British guy in conflict studies, I had the story here, but I don't have it at the moment, interviewed yesterday saying, well, there will have to be an accounting, and there have been so many atrocities committed by the regime that it's inevitable that there will be a little adjustment of the circumstances between the regime and their enemies. And that's what's happening now, only it plays out as massacres. And you won't see them reported as massacres because, and then this is the larger picture, nobody who matters wanted Syria to survive. And a lot of people who do matter invested billions, and I mean billions, in seeing it destroyed. And what made it more vindictive for these people is that they failed. I mean, they failed really badly, and their money was invested to no good cause. And every time they failed, they sort of got humiliated within their pathetic little world, and they got angrier and angrier and were more willing to countenance any level of violence in as long as it was accompanied by the dismemberment of Syria, the handing over to Israel of any part that it considered useful or strategic, the consignment of the rest to the worst people in the place, the people who had really gotten addicted to killing on a large scale and wanted a larger field to practice it. So, you know, that's going to happen. And whatever you hear on most Western media, it's likely to be minimized. And you will hear once it's safe, like a month, 2 months, depends on the media environment, you will hear reasoned voices in the papers of record and the other news sites of respectability that we may have made a few mistakes on the number of those killed when Syria was, quote, liberated. We may have underestimated the number of killings. And if we did, that's really regrettable, but it is, you know, one of the costs of freeing the country. And that will be the sanitized version of it, if that even happens. I mean, sometimes no one bothers to say that. Sometimes it depends on how many people care domestically within the U.S. or Britain, really, because those are the only places that matter. And there aren't a lot of Syrians in either of those places. So they may not even bother to correct the accounts. until the jihadis of Syria become hot enemies again, which they will. And then all these crimes, which they knew about the whole time, will be resurrected and used to scare the gullible audience about what they might do in the future. But until then, until they might do something to us, their crimes will be completely hidden and nobody will pay any price for refusing to talk about them. I mean, we've seen this too many times to be naive about it.
Yeah, we paid so much more attention to this with the show and doing this regularly. So it's just such an obvious pattern. And it was obvious that when Jolani / Shara came to power, however more sort of quote-unquote pragmatic he is, he is nevertheless, you know, steeped in a sectarian supremacy, ideology that is a sectarian supremacist ideology. And he's got tens of thousands of, you know, gangs running around that are under a certain amount of discipline, but not completely. And it's not necessarily, he may not see it as completely in his interest. What he wants is for them to, he wants their killings, their atrocities and intimidations. He just doesn't want them making it into the international media, which could hurt, you know, aid and whatever else he needs. But he does want them to discipline the minorities and the population.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And revenge is a real possibility.
And revenge, like,
they have been shamed. And a militia that's been shamed and defeated over and over, because the militias have not been worth much in combat, with the exception in some terms of Islamic State. But that raises the issue of, you know, how do you compare Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, Jolani's organization? Hayat Tahrir al-Sham means Organization for the Liberation of the Levant. Jolani is not really Jolani. That's a nom de guerre. He's Shara', his full name was Ahmed Hussein al-Shara'. He was born in 1982. He fought in 2003 to 2006, as far as anybody knows, with al-Qaeda in Iraq. He created Jabhat al-Nusra, the Nusra Front. There was a bounty on his head. This is one of the bitter ironies of U.S. international politics, such as it is. There was a $10 million bounty on his head while he was in Iraq. He crosses back to Syria, and he instantly becomes an asset rather than a problem. He creates this Nusra Front, which has a sort of mixed record as a militia. It's a very typical militia. It's lightly armed with, you know, the usual set, machine guns, RPGs, divided into 11 units named after Muhammad's companions. They were originally based in Ghouta near Damascus. Mm. They had a lot of very bloody offensives in the suburbs of Damascus using suicide bombers. And eventually, in a slow process of attrition, they were ground down by the regime forces, which involved a lot of population exchanges. This is the time when population exchanges were supposed to help Syria. So in a long, long process, which, by the way, involved the killing of dozens of children of Alawite families who were drawn to an ice cream truck, which then exploded, which got very little coverage, even though it was an absolute slaughter. they moved in an exchange of populations to the far northwest of Syria, which had once been another Kurdish enclave. But the reason that they were more welcome there than anywhere else is that the Turkish regime did not consider jihadis dangerous, partly because they were so contemptible militarily and no match for the Turkish army. They could be used as cat's paws, and they could be eventually pushed back into Syria with Kurdish air and artillery power, which is what happened first in Idlib, this little chunk of the northwest corner of Syria. And then when the time was right, which was late in 2024, they could be unleashed with, I suspect, a lot of special forces help from not just Turkey, but probably the United States and other NATO powers, because the hatred of the Syrian regime, the last living Ba'ath regime in the Middle East, was intense and longstanding among many governments. So I cannot prove this, but I suspect that special forces were used as force multipliers in this breakout, because there was a sudden loss of morale among the Assadist forces, which was probably real. I mean, Assad was nobody you'd want to die for. But it would make a lot of sense if also there were little laser designators run by special forces from the U.S., Turkey, and other NATO alliances.
And bags of money, because the population, like, so whatever forces were the Assadist forces had all turned into racketeers. It's so easy to buy them off. They didn't want to fight for Assad, a lot of them. You know, they just sort of stepped aside. That was most of HTS's, you know, lightning fast advance was Assad's forces getting out of the way. And I would just imagine money had something to do with that as well.
I think you're right. Yeah. I always underestimate money. It's one of my real one of my real weaknesses in terms of analyzing war. But yeah, you're right.
It's just a guess, but yeah.
No, I think it's true. But, you know, the strange thing is, as late as 2018, Turkey declared HTS, Jolani's group, as a terrorist group. They still worked with it.
It gives them leverage. I mean, the U.S. kept them on... They kept that fake bounty on Jolani officially until he, you know, moved into Damascus and took power. And I remember I saved the screenshot from one day when the wanted page was still there in the State Department, I think it was. It's either State Department or Department of Justice. And then I took a screenshot when the URL was still there, but it was removed. It was like a 404. And I think it's just, it's leverage to keep them in line, not in terms of killing people, but in terms of, you know, doing things roughly how we want them done. But let's not also underestimate here the role that Israel played by kneecapping Hezbollah. You know, that played a huge role.
Yeah, Hezbollah was the real constraint on the Idlib breakout, because they would have fought hard, as they always fought, and kept them in there. But at some point, Jolani signaled his change by saying many, many times, we have no ambition to hurt anybody in the West.
Yes.
We're not concerned with that. I mean, 10 years earlier, he was saying some fairly bloodthirsty jihadist stuff. But no, not now. And accordingly, he switched his look. He switched his look from the sort of pseudo-Bedouin style of the jihadi to three-piece suits. And He said, we have no interest in pushing Islamist rules. Quote, governance should be consistent with Sharia, but not like Islamic State or even Saudi Arabia. So less than Saudi Arabia, which is pretty strong. The one thing they sort of did insist on, and this is sort of consistent with their, you know, Syrian hick status, was gender segregation in the schools. That was very strict. The rest of the stuff, it was like Orwell compares something to those photos where you have a cat and a bird and a dog forcibly posed together in friendship. So they purposely got along and, or made a show of getting along temporarily with the local minorities in Idlib. But clearly that mask came off when they went down to the heartland of their ethnic enemies down in Latakia. So he did everything that they wanted. And I suspect that what Western intelligence really wanted, or Western plus Turkey plus Israel intelligence really wanted, was you're not going to send anybody to blow up Cleveland or Birmingham, are you?
Yeah, that's number one for the West. That you can be an Islamist, a violent Islamist and a sectarian, a kind of Sunni supremacist sectarian, but just keep it within your borders. You can kill all the people in your borders. It's when it goes out beyond the borders and destabilizes us. But also I think they want even the killing within the borders to be measured to a degree, because the Europeans don't want another refugee crisis. Neither do the Turks, for that matter.
Right.
I think that's why he changed it from al-Nusra, which was, al-Qaeda's largest franchise in the world, and which is global jihad, to HTS. And also, Nusra's brand might have been hurt a little bit in the U.S. because a couple of terrorist attacks in the U.S., I think, were the guy who shot up the gay nightclub. He cited, I think, al-Nusra as one of his inspirations, al-Nusra right. and ISIS. So that's when you want to change the branding, change the name. And I think because he is Syrian, unlike a lot of the jihadists in Nusra and even HTS, but he is Syrian, it's a little easier for him to switch to, as Cyrus said, to kind of Hutu supremacist nationalism. From something right. internationalist, yeah.
And, well, he also, in line with that, he also exiled a couple of years ago. He exiled hundreds of non-Syrian fighters to Turkey. What you've got here is jihadis stacked up in various safe houses, essentially. Like, Idlib is one sort of safe house for people who you are going to use in the near future to break out into the rest of Syria. But these non-Syrian jihadis, probably they went to Gaziantep near Idlib in Turkey. And they were just non-Syrian fighters who were just told to stay there and shut up under the guidance or the control of the Turkish intelligence, which, of course, was working really carefully with Jolani. So he was able to present a fully Syrian, very un-Islamic State, un-Al-Qaeda-like nationalist front. And also, this coincided with the fact that Jolani, by all accounts, is a very scheming, careful megalomaniac. And he does not like rivals. He killed a lot of rivals along the way, and he doesn't want a bunch of internationalist communists. There are many parallels, from the communist movement. Like, never mind all that internationalist stuff. I'm going to run this place.
Yeah, and the internationalist stuff is only going to cause more problems. It's like, yeah, it's Sunni sectarian jihadism in one country rather than internationally.
Yeah, because, I mean, the thing about Sunni sectarianism is that no matter how much you pretend that it's a set of universal rules that are direct from the Prophet, there's always an element of local tradition that comes into it, just as there is in United States Christianity, for example. And you can't eliminate that. So people are always going to be objecting to this or that and suggesting that you punish people for some infraction of what is actually a cultural rule, masquerading as a religious rule. And you really can't have that, not while you're still under the observation and sort of the tutelage and provisional approval of the Western intelligence services that are running you.
Yeah, so we should emphasize again that although real large-scale and gleefully filmed violence, well, pogroms by these jihadist groups and Jelani's HTS forces against the Alawites, but also Christians. Even though we're seeing a lot of this now, and you know, the numbers range of killed just in the last couple of days range from 500 to 1,000 plus. This, as you said, John, has been going on since they took power at a lower level of violence. A lower level of like murder, I guess, but nonstop harassment and killings and it's just, it got too big. And what happened in the last few days was that some former regime, Assad regime, Alawites, I think they've been talking about forming their own sort of resistance forces within Latakia, however you pronounce it, and maybe Tartus, they've been talking about forming them. And it's that province is pretty ideal for an insurgency because it's very mountainous, very rocky, a lot of villages. It's pretty ideal if you're an insurgent. And they finally apparently started fighting back and taking out a handful of HTS fighters. And Jelani basically gave the green light to all of these vengeful, very vengeful throat slitters in the north of the country that have been kind of bottled up there, waiting for the chance for a green light, for permission to do what they really want to do, which is murder and rape the minorities. And they've gone crazy, and they've killed, as I've said, you know, almost entirely Alawites, but also some Christians. Got a message from Cyrus that they killed their first mayor, Christian mayor of a town. It's a town somewhere outside of Homs, in West Homs. So there are, and I've seen elsewhere on social media that Christians are also getting killed, but it's primarily Alawites. And the glee from the sort of the HTS fan club and the throat slitters themselves. I mean, you can see it all over social media. But the PR cover for it is what's just so sickening because no one, it's maybe the Ukraine war is close to this, but the advocates for the so-called Syrian revolution throughout the 2010s were the most sanctimonious, self-righteous, liberal humanitarians. And now what they're saying is they're doing the very genocidal thing, which is, all the people getting killed are Assadists.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck is an Assadist today? He's gone. When I hear Alawites talk, they're pissed. They hate Assad. They're Alawites without a leader. They're not Assadists. They might have been in the Assad's regime, maybe or maybe not. But to call them an Assadist is to put to paint a target on their backs and say,
absolutely,
you have permission to kill.
It's gross. And I mean, I hope those people know that there are people who will record everything they've said, and that I pray to God they will have to hear it 10 years from now, because I don't think many of them, if any of them have a conscience, would be very happy to hear what they're saying at the moment. But, You know, the people who've been hissed and silenced when they said this would happen are now trying to get the attention of those that they were trying to talk to. Like Rania Khalek said something like, you know, I told you this would happen. I told you and told you. And Ali Abu Nima replied to her like, yes, but remember the assembled grad students of the anthro departments of some very esteemed university told you you were wrong and told you to be quiet.
And to listen to Syrian agency. You're denying Syrian agency.
Syrian agency.
Yeah.
Man. And yeah, you do kind of want to spit in the faces of the people who said that.
Yeah. So we want to keep an eye on those people. And, you know, Charles Lister is at the top of the list of the list, speaking of list of that, of people running cover and for these massacres. I mean, they're literally dropping barrel bombs. I don't know if you've seen the videos of this. They're filming themselves dropping barrel bombs. I'm saying the HTS fighters are in helicopters loading barrel bombs and dropping them out over civilian communities. And what they're doing is, I mean, the massacres have a purpose. The idea is to, it's counterinsurgency in the ugliest way, as Assad did it, which is you massacre, you can't find the actual fighters maybe, so you massacre their families or their relatives or their, you know, the friends of their relatives so that there's pain and that.
And they
that,
flee if they can, but I don't think they can flee. I don't think there's anywhere to go.
Yeah.
I mean, the strange thing is, long, long ago, people said, do you know what that graffiti, those graffiti on the walls say? It says, Christians to Beirut, Alawites to the graveyard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they actually mean that.
Yep.
And people said, you know, shut up. You're denying Syrian agency.
Let's take a quick break, do a little vomiting, and come back and finish up with a few other stories going on.
Thank you.
Okay, we're back. Let's just run down a few things, a few more items on the list. First one, I think, is that I just have to talk about this a little bit, that Trump, the Canadians went from thinking Trump is trolling them about Canada becoming the 51st state and Trump tweeting out, calling Justin Trudeau, you know, thank you, governor, you know, calling him Governor Trudeau and this stuff, to thinking, holy shit, he's deadly serious. Now, I've been hearing this from a couple of journalists I know in Canada saying that the governing media class, and I don't know about other classes, are actually really freaking out and taking it very seriously. And Trump has basically said to Trudeau in some of their conversations that he wants to take another look at the border demarcation treaty signed with the British in 1908, that demarcates who gets what parts of the Great Lakes. And he's also apparently might be making a claim on some of eastern, kind of southeastern Ontario province, or he's holding out that possibility. And I can't believe he's gonna call for renaming.
That is truly bizarre. I hadn't even heard that. Like, that has been, well, if there's one pattern that stands out in the American military tradition, it's don't invade Canada. It never works, and it's a lot harder than you think.
Yeah. I don't, you know, it's some kind of bowling to get something else. They've cut out, they apparently are cutting the Canadians out of the Five Eyes. And I can't help but think that there's something political going on here. It's something about the Trudeau administration's role with the Democratic Party and the center, you know, the centrist establishment, and what went on with Russiagate and Ukraine and the first Trump administration. I mean, you know, it's not right to just put everything Trump does down to vengeance and spite. It is there in a big way, but there'll always be some other interests that would dovetail with that to bring it together into a real policy. Same with Ukraine. I mean, we've gone over like what Trump's personal interest is, but there is also a real politic argument for scaling down the Ukraine war and bringing peace there that dovetails with Trump's own personal loathing for the Ukraine cause.
Right.
And, you know, and
but
so
the difference to me would be, and I'm no expert here, but like, there is a real populist dislike for further meddling in foreign wars,
yes,
which fueled Trump's vote,
yes,
and that centered on Ukraine. I'm not aware of any populist anger toward Canada or
I know
eagerness for a war with Canada.
I don't know any of it either, and I honestly can't. I mean, you just see online Trumpist accounts and they're so gripery and so like trolly, you know, that it's hard to know if, I don't know, I don't take them that seriously. Like, they just love the trolling. They love the trolling and they amplify the trolling. But I don't know if anybody, like, you know, your average nurse in a VA hospital, like I was talking about, I don't think they listen to it and I don't think they take it seriously. And Trump may be using the bullying and the scaring to get some kind of trade concessions is my best guess. But, you know, there is a lot of chaos going on here and chaos within the administration. There was this article in the New York Times, it's pretty kind of amazing article. I think it just came out today about cabinet meetings with Elon Musk there. Musk fighting with Rubio, who's the Secretary of State. Musk is basically, he's like this free-floating, you know, I don't know, this free-floating like executioner who walks around and he's pissing off all the cabinet members. So Trump has kind of sent him out there and then pulls him back and says, oh, he doesn't have power. And then Musk started telling Rubio, you're not firing anybody. You know, you're not doing anything. And then Rubio, I think, got sick of being deferential and started fighting openly with Musk. And they had a shouting match about how both, you know, the other one is a complete idiot. And it described Trump kind of really enjoying it with his hands folded and listening to it, which I can really imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's classic strongman behavior.
Yes.
And of course, Rubio and Musk are a made-in-heaven comedy team. I mean, the last time I saw a photo of Rubio, it was an Ash Wednesday photo, and yes, he had an ash cross on his forehead that I swear looked like it was spray painted on. I mean, because most priests of recent vintage are very wary, yes, of, you know, doing any sectarian marks, so they give you a useless little ashy white cross. But no, Rubio, yeah, had this big black cross that was all over his forehead. So
dead by Don, yeah, dead by Don. Yeah. It was kind of over the top there, Marco, little Marco.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so on Ukraine, just real quickly, you know, Trump has continued to strangle Ukraine. It's pretty brutal by any stretch. I mean, that war does need to end. Maybe there's no way to do it nicely, and I'm not sure Ukraine's just going to fold up anytime soon. But Trump is being punitive about it. They cut off intelligence sharing, and U.S. intelligence sharing is probably the most important. I mean, aside, of course, from money and weapons, but the intelligence sharing has been huge, not, on top of everything else, to also make the weapons work, like the HIMARS and the right, longer range rockets, and they just cut them off. And, you know, publicly Trump has been saying Putin wants peace. And I don't know about the Ukrainians. They don't seem to want peace. They don't want the peace. And it's just like, and so he's trying to break them to just come to any peace deal, because for Trump, that's what looks good, even if it's a terrible, which it will be, terrible peace for Ukraine. You know, on the other hand, the longer the war goes on, the more Ukraine seems to lose. So,
people, you know, above all, they can't people, really, yes, afford any more people.
And what's happening right now as we speak is that Kursk pocket. I mean, it's already been reduced before Trump took office to about a third, a little more than a third of its size at its highest point last September. But the Russians managed to cut off the main supply road, which is already, I've seen video of it, is just littered with burned out vehicles because it's been under fire control for a while through drones, through fiber optic drones that the Russians are really good at using, and they're hard to jam because,
you know, and that's one of the saddest ways to die for, yeah, a Ukrainian soldier in all of this war, that you die for a few paragraphs of publicity in the Western media, really,
yeah,
because what happened was Ukraine was experiencing a difficult time on the eastern battlefields. So some genius in the Ukraine cabinet came up with the idea of, you know, the Russians aren't watching in this northern front, so we can make a few miles and it'll look good on the maps that are published in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm. And briefly, it did get them some really good publicity because they had all the Western media hacks teed up to go touring Ukrainian-occupied Kursk and all the articles. Everything was massaged in advance. And it did do that very briefly, but it accelerated their losses in the far more important Donbas front. They're anywhere from, I don't know, 4,000 to 6,000 or more Ukrainian soldiers that have been kind of effectively cut off. Wounded are through. You know, people have to get out if they are ever ordered to retreat. We've talked about this a lot in the war since 2023. The one thing that Commander Sirsky does not like doing is calling retreats. I mean, he's expending, yeah, his forces very liberally.
Makes for a difficult cabinet meeting, I would think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's happened. It's just looking very bad. And, you know, we'll get more into that war again. We just cannot be It's just it's going to go from bad to worse there for the Ukrainians. And the Russians, of course, are very excited about all this. I mean, why wouldn't they be? I have to say, and I'm going to say this again, I don't see the war ending quickly. You know, Trump wants this thing to end now. He wants all these big, wins in his first 100 days. And I don't think he's going to come up with the sort of ceasefire plan that would get the Russians to stop when the war is going so much their way. And the whole point of this war was, for Putin, was I'm not going to ever stop again and do another Minsk deal because I get screwed on those. This needs to be a final, you know, this is like war as the ultimate politics deciding everything.
Well, you know, I will make a NATO punditry prediction here that soon you will see NATO pundits, who are among the stupidest people on earth, eagerly promoting guerrilla warfare for the Ukrainians, you know, after the Russian army pushes through the fronts, if it does so. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are more than willing to sacrifice every Ukrainian civilian to the horrors, and they are horrors, of guerrilla war.
Mm-hmm. Moving on real quickly, that Gallup poll, I think we wanted to say a word about it. That was a real stunner for older folks like us, where sentiment in the Democratic Party has shifted hugely towards sympathy with Palestinians and less so.
Really stunning.
Yeah. Israelis. I didn't realize that it had manifested itself this starkly.
No, we sort of expected to be on the despised minority side.
Like maybe a larger minority, but still, the despised minority. But it explains the election results of last year, too, because the Democrat, you know, establishment does not want to acknowledge this. 59% of Democrats say they sympathize more with Palestinians than with Israelis. And I think it was 21%.
Whereas Republicans were absolutely solid behind Israel. Yes. And this confirms something that I've been thinking a lot after reading centrist papers like the NYT. The Democratic National Committee and the people who really run the Democratic Party would be much happier with the Republican base than they are with the Democratic base.
Absolutely. And that's why they keep trying to reach out to them. And it turns out that the Republican base is MAGA. And the old sort of, I don't know, center-right base, it's very thin because of the politics of the last 40 years have hollowed out that kind of class. And part of it is the empire has hollowed out that class. It just doesn't exist the way they want it to. But in the donor class, in the upper class, it really exists. It is dominant, I would say, in the 1% class. That's what matters. But I find that, you know, that is at least some positive news for an otherwise, you know, a horrific couple of years and beyond for Palestinians and the Gaza war. Because as we've kind of said, we thought would happen and now it's happening, Israel has become a one-party issue. And that's not good if you are a hardcore Israel type. It's really bad and stupid for Israel, but it's kind of unavoidable given Israel's politics. They are a one-party cause, and that's going to hurt Israel at some point. The very last thing I wanted to say, and this would also be for a larger episode, but I just wanted to mention this, you know, that Öcalan, the leader of the PKK, came out for... called on the PKK to put down weapons.
I don't know
weapons.
What to say.
I know. I don't either.
Seems bad, but I don't know what kind of bad it means, and I don't know whether all of the Kurdish militias will obey. He's been in prison for a long time, and I don't know how much clout he actually has over the fighters.
I mean, I get the sense he has a lot of clout, but that clout may not fully may not extend to actually dissolving the PKK, because They have complied with a ceasefire. But why would they dissolve it without huge guarantees of some, with some outside?
Yeah, there are no guarantees. There are none that would mean anything. Massacre is a real possibility, and they know that. So.
And I heard one sort of, I don't know, expert on PKK talking who said, you know, it's interesting that what Erdogan has done here as he's gotten, instead of reaching out to the more kind of systemic mainstream Kurdish parties that he's completely quashed and repressed, you know, out banned parties, jailed politicians, instead of working through them, he's working through this prisoner reach out to the Kurds. And there's something extremely fishy about that as well, right? Like if he was a lot more serious about this, why wouldn't he work through the people who tried working through democratic electoral means, however much democracy is there. Yeah. But anyway, we'll keep an eye. It's just something to keep an eye on and maybe do a future episode on because there's a lot there as well. Okay, I think we could end the episode here. Thanks again to everyone. And thanks, John and Brendan. And we'll talk soon.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.